The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you interested in the cutting edge of investing? That means frontier and emerging markets. And would you like to get started? Or perhaps you are already investing but still have questions. Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. On today's program, we'll take a look at news, trends, and background information that you should know to become an informed investor in new and emerging opportunities. Now, here is your host, Gavin Graham.
Good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you're listening to us today. This is Emerging and Frontier Market Investing, and I am Gavin Graham. And I'm here with you on Voice America each Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific, and 2 p.m. in the UK. With my guests, I look at emerging and frontier market investing. We examine these markets, the factors that impact them, and what all of this means for your investments. We look at where they are right now and what we believe the future holds in these markets. My guests are analysts, journalists, fund managers, and experts in their field and in this area. And I spent most of my professional life analyzing investments and hiring fund managers to handle large amounts of investors' money. So I figure I can spot the difference between promising investments and ones that perhaps are less promising. By emerging markets, we mean the BRIC countries, that's Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And that also includes such markets as Turkey, Chile, Mexico, and the Czech Republic. Today, we'll be checking into the tumult in Brazil over the last couple of weeks and have a look at Turkey. By frontier markets, we mean countries like Colombia, Vietnam, Nigeria, Kenya, Bangladesh, Kazakhstan, Panama, Slovenia, Botswana, and some of the Middle East nations. Today, we'll be looking at Bangladesh and whether the problems in Bahrain will affect the safe haven status of the United Arab Emirates. I'm going to start today's program, however, with a look at Brazil, Paris, France, and I have Bill Hinchberger, who we've spoken to several times, on the line from the Sorbonne in Paris, where he covers Brazil. For the Sorbonne University, having covered the country for many years for publications such as the Financial Times. He also covers a number of emerging and frontier markets, but today we're going to look at the short and medium-term impact of the disturbances that have been taking place over the last week or so in Brazil. Welcome to the program, Bill.
Hello, Gavin.
So the street protest caused by an increase in bus fares has led to several deaths, rioting, destruction, and according to reports, over 1 million demonstrators have demanded improved government services and the end of corruption. While this is clearly not the case of a Brazilian spring, so to speak, is there something more to it than obviously just a protest about increased bus fares?
Yeah, I mean, the increased bus fares was just the spark of something to... You know, it's one of these little things that sort of, you know, goes on its own sort of logic after a while. There was the protests against the bus fares, and then there was some police violence in reaction to that protest, especially in Sao Paulo. And then the things just sort of, you know, swelled up from there. I think there was a lot of pent-up frustration about people. Brazil is a country where 36% of the GDP goes to taxes, goes to the government, but that government services, including transportation, which sparked the thing, but also health and other things, the government services are not up to the level of the taxes that people pay. So there's a lot of frustration about that, you know, sort of pent up, and once this thing, you know, started going, they just took off.
So, as you say, just something fairly minor in the scheme of things, but at the same time, representative of frustration with the level of government services, the poor level of government services. How much of it is due to our anger at both corruption and maybe the misspending of resources on things like the Soccer World Cup next year and the Summer Olympics in 2016?
Exactly. So you've got corruption scandals that have been coming up, and you had a well-publicized one last year where a lot of people from Lula's government especially were convicted but haven't found their way to prisons yet. So there's frustration among the populace about that, wondering if they'll ever get into prison. And then there's also this, as you mentioned, this coincides, the protests, with the Confederations Cup, which is kind of like a warm-up tournament for the you know, warm-up for the Soccer World Cup. So that sort of brings into everybody's mind how much the society is spending on football and how much it's not spending relative to that on things like health and education and transport. So I think, you know, it's kind of one of these perfect storm things where a lot of these frustrations sort of hit at the same time.
Yes, somebody was making the only slightly tongue-in-cheek remark that such is the incompetence of football's governing body, FIFA, that they managed to make the Brazilians dislike soccer, which is truly remarkable. How about you said there was a big corruption scandal from the previous socialist government under President Lula, Inácio da Silva. There's also obviously some concerns about the picture that Lula was painting in terms of how well Brazil was doing, how successful it had been in addressing a large number of the problems that it had. Was that maybe a little bit too much of a rosy picture? And is there now some sort of reaction, not merely obviously by the locals who were very aware of the fact that maybe that was too optimistic, but by foreign investors who maybe feel that they were overly optimistic?
Yeah, I think that Lula is an excellent marketer. I mean, that's his best, you know, trait as a politician. And I don't say that disparagingly. I mean, I compare him a lot to Ronald Reagan, you know, and they call Reagan the great communicator. The thing that Lula was able to do was Reagan was able to convince Americans, but he wasn't necessarily able to convince the rest of the world. Lula was able to convince both Brazilians and the rest of the world. And and Brazil was riding a pretty good time. They had made some major reforms before Lula took office, especially to end inflation and to address some of the problems in terms of by privatizing public companies and different things, some of the regulatory agencies. And so they were there, and also the starting of the sort of the redistribution programs, which Lula expanded. So Lula was able to, you know, take those realities and run with them and market them, and in many cases sort of take credit for things that previous governments had done. But, you know, now kind of reality setting in. You haven't had a lot of reforms and changes in recent years. So, you know, the cycle that you benefited from these changes sort of in the late 90s and the early 2000s are now, you know, sort of coming up, well, what now? And yeah. I think, you know, it's the time for reality to set in. People look hard at Brazil.
And obviously with the sharp slowdown in growth, with what, about 1% growth last year, there was the expectation that there'd be a pickup because of the World Cup and the Olympics. But at the same time, we've been already seeing redemptions from Brazil funds and emerging market funds generally. But obviously, Brazil is felt to be particularly badly affected by the slowdown in China, given its very big commodity exposure and the fact that the Chinese and Brazilian governments have been very strong on building that relationship. So are the disturbances likely to accelerate those redemptions, and will it actually be a major damper on economic growth this year and next?
There's an old saying by he's a late bossa nova composer called Tom Jobim, who wrote co-wrote The Girl from Ipanema and other songs, obviously. And he said, Brazil is not for beginners. So I think what you may have in some of the redemptions you're talking about are people who don't really get Brazil, haven't been through one of these things before, because you had protests about 20 years ago where they impeached a president. And looking maybe some of these investors having experience in other parts of the world and thinking that this might be a systemic crisis in terms of, you know, constitutional situation or something like that. I think one thing's important to watch in Brazil is that both sides, both the protesters and the government, are in favor of the rule of law in general and are in favor of, you know, sort of a peaceful resolution of this. The violence has been isolated. inflated and by some rogue elements within the protests, but and some overreaction or misreaction by the police. But they've been individuals. They haven't been, you know, sort of institutional on either side of the thing. So I think what this might offer is for people to look more seriously at the Brazil portfolio, and if they really think Brazil is interesting, to maybe focus it a little bit better and take advantage of the, you know, sort of the cold feet that some of the people who aren't so experienced might be having.
No, I think that's a very fair point, Bill. As you say, really you need to go through an emerging market cycle, and that's usually around 4 to 5 years, because things are really good on the upside and maybe look really bad on the downside when you have an instance such as this. But as you said, maybe savvy investors might be looking to pick up some of the bargains that have been created. Do you feel that it's worthwhile stepping back into the market at the present time, or would you wait until there's maybe some resolution of the specific problems that have been caused, causing this disruption?
Well, the specific problems that are causing this disruption are long-term problems that are going to need to be resolved by actions in on the political realm, either by the president or by Congress. But I don't think that reality has really changed. Those things needed to happen 2 months ago. What you have now is a greater voice on the part of the people. In fact, one really interesting thing that happened yesterday was there was a constitutional amendment that and it's a little bit complicated, so I don't want to go into too much detail, but to basically make it more difficult to investigate corrupt politicians. And that looked like it might pass up until these protests. That was one of the big major issues of the protesters. The vote yesterday voted that down almost unanimously. So there is some reaction on the political front to some of the concerns by the protesters. So I think I think I would be optimistic. This wouldn't be for me to step back now. I would say now take advantage of the fact that some people that don't understand the country so well are stepping out and, you know, take up those things maybe at lower prices.
Yeah, that I think would be a sensible advice in any of the emerging markets when you get such excitements as we've been having, as long as you're comfortable with a longer-term investment thesis, of course. Thanks very much indeed, Bill. I appreciate you taking the time.
One thing that's important here is that I don't think any of the institutions, you know, we're not going to have an end of democracy in Brazil. Democracy is going to continue. There was a dictatorship in the 70s and early 80s. Nobody wants that again. So I think, you know, basically if you're comfortable with the basic overall situation, you can move forward in Brazil and take advantage of the situation.
That's excellent. Thanks very much indeed, Bill, and I appreciate your giving us your insight on the Brazilian market.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. And so that was Bill Hinchberger on the line from Paris, where he lectures about Brazil at the Sorbonne, for those insights into the country. And I think that's a very true statement indeed by the co-composer of The Girl from Ipanema. Brazil is not for beginners, although one quite frankly could say that of a number of major emerging markets. There are lots of cross currents, but I think Bill's conclusion about this is an opportunity if you're comfortable with the longer term outlook for the country may well end up being excellent advice. My next guest after the break will have a look at some very familiar company names that could be in your portfolio and what they're doing in Africa. For that, I'll head to Baltimore, Maryland, and Nancy Hubbard, who is professor at Goucher College there. Please stay with us.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
This program is produced by EFMI Media, which has become the leader in information about emerging and frontier markets investing. EFMI recently compiled the book entitled Investing in Frontier Markets: Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, set for release by John Wiley & Sons later this year, and another book, also on frontier markets, which will be on store bookshelves later in the year. We are also launching a newsletter called EFMI. For more information, email info@emergingfrontier.ca. For more news about upcoming program segments, the books we have written, or the EFMI newsletter, please email info@emergingfrontier.ca. You can call 416-944-1750.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. In the previous segment, we were looking at Brazil. In this one, we're going to go across the South Atlantic to Africa. We've talked about the efforts of various multinational corporations to increase the percentage of their revenues coming from emerging and frontier markets, given the excellent fundamentals in those countries. Some of the analysts and commentators refer to these as tailwinds, meaning that the revenues get an extra boost because of the strong underlying fundamentals. On this program and in our book on frontier markets entitled Investing in Frontier Markets, we suggest you get most of your emerging and frontier market exposure through global funds, but you may actually have some exposure already through domestic funds or corporations which have a large percentage of their revenue coming from these fast-growing economies. I have Nancy Hubbard on the line from Goucher College in Baltimore, Maryland, where she holds the Miriam Kadowitz Chair in Management and Accounting. She's also the author of Conquering Global Markets, Secrets from the World's Most Successful Multinationals. During her research, she interviewed multinational players, including British Petroleum, BT, Cargill, Ford, Lafarge, SAP, Cadbury Schweppes, Standard Bank, Diageo, and others. And today, she's going to give us some clues about the plans of these companies in Africa. Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing, Nancy.
Thank you so much for having me back.
A great pleasure, because this is a very large subject, and it's good to have the opportunity to revisit some of the themes we were talking about. How do these major multinational companies view Africa? Is it a big target for some of them?
It really depends on the company, and it depends on the country. For companies such as infrastructure companies, resources, fast-moving consumer goods, Africa is really one of the final frontiers. South America has been kind of stitched up by the Spanish-speaking European companies, so Santander's in South America. So Africa really offers an opportunity for a lot of these companies, and it's becoming increasingly visible on the radar screen.
And obviously, as you said, it depends on individual companies. You mentioned some of the industries like fast-moving consumer goods, utilities and the like. But are there specific countries that they've been focusing on, and has that changed at all in the last little while, given what's been happening in some of the African countries?
Absolutely. Before the Arab Spring, the northern African countries were very much in favor, especially Egypt was very popular because of its oil, because of its size, and because of its increasing GDP. But since its instability, it has actually tailed off a bit. So other countries have kind of moved more into the fore. So Morocco was still very attractive in northern Africa. Kenya has become increasingly attractive because the government has realized the opportunities that are available and has begun some significant government reform in an attempt to gain foreign direct investment. And Nigeria, of all the companies, countries in Africa we discussed, Nigeria was the most popular, especially with the Japanese companies. I spoke to 9 Japanese companies, companies like Sony, Hitachi, Uniqlo, Nidec, Mitsubishi Chemical. Nigeria is attractive. It's one of the largest countries in the world with 170 million people. The government, although struggles with the corruption issues, although they understand this and they seem to be making amends on trying to work towards that. So Nigeria was the most popular, most commonly mentioned, shall I say. Kenya, Morocco, Zambia was seen as very attractive because mm-hmm. it was considered a very well-managed and stable company and politically very, very stable. Ghana, Botswana, were also very popular, again, because of their oil and reserves, and natural resources. And also, Tanzania and Mauritius and, Cape Verde were also attracting high foreign direct investment flows.
That's an interesting list of, countries, because some of them, as you would anticipate, Nigeria, obviously, because of its large size, Morocco and Kenya, where the government, as you say, has definitely been making an effort to attract foreign investment. But other ones, maybe I certainly wouldn't necessarily have put Zambia at the top of the list, although, as you say, it is a very well-managed economy, likewise Botswana. So talking about these different countries, you would say the Japanese were especially focusing on Nigeria. Is there any interest from other Asian economies as well in Africa?
Yes, it's been proven time and again. China is the biggest investor in Africa at the moment, and they are really cementing their position. They had one of their largest banks, ICBC, bought 20% of Standard Bank, the largest bank in Africa, and they are really using that relationship much to their advantage. They have seconded Chinese speakers to many of the major bank branches at Standard Bank throughout Africa. And Standard Bank has also seconded senior executives to Beijing to work with ICBC to really maximize that relationship. So I really don't see the China position actually getting any weaker. In fact, I think it's going to get stronger. And so I think perhaps as a reaction to that, Japan and the Japanese companies being very far-sighted have said this is clearly an opportunity and we should be investing. Now, what's also happening is some of the British companies and French companies and to a very small extent American companies have also decided that Africa presents, let's call it a long-term insurance policy. It's kind of like we missed getting into China when we should have, mm-hmm. So maybe perhaps we can get into Africa. As the cost to enter is really quite low in a lot of these countries.
Absolutely. So, as you said, European companies, multinational companies, who perhaps feel they might have missed out in China or have not been able to get into Latin America because of the Spanish-speaking companies being first on the ground, is there a certain element, perhaps, of historic connection there? Because obviously, France and Great Britain had the vast majority of the continent as part of their empires a century ago. Is that one of the reasons why they're continuing to actually make a major effort there?
Absolutely. The fact that the law is either Napoleonic law or British law makes it very attractive for these companies to enter into those markets. They understand the law. The English language is being used in a business context in many places across the board. So that does make it much easier. So if you look at some of the companies that are active in Africa, we have Diageo, which is very active across Africa, and it has been for 200 years, and Longro, which is, although it's a British quoted company, I understand it's being taken private right now, but it also operates in every country in Africa. And interestingly, the only other company that does is Coca-Cola. So they got in, again, fast-moving consumer goods got in very early. But they have been there for generations, both Diageo and Coca-Cola. But we are starting to see a reemergence of companies entering again. Especially, we're seeing some very large acquisitions, mega acquisitions into Africa, where you have a target that's over $1 billion. And we've seen Uganda, Angola, Equatorial Guinea all take part in those. Interestingly, the one country we haven't discussed is South Africa. And South Africa almost doesn't fit the mold because, excuse me, just taking the example of mega acquisitions, South Africa's had $17 billion plus acquisition targets. And the next nearest country, I believe, is Uganda, has had three. So it's really in a completely different scale in terms of infrastructure, of banking, of regulation and corruption. So South Africa is almost not considered Africa in many ways.
No, it's a effectively developed market in a continent which doesn't have a great deal of competition. Thanks very much. Absolutely. Indeed, Nancy. That's fascinating stuff. And again, Hopefully we can revisit and maybe have a look at another region or two where the multinationals are looking in the frontier and emerging markets, because obviously I imagine some of the same themes will be emerging as to which industries, but also there may be some differences.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Thanks so much. That was Nancy Hubbard, who is a professor at Goucher College in Baltimore, Maryland. My next guest is in Dhaka, Bangladesh, and he's going to give us an update on the situation there. Hi, Manirul. So we have Manirul Asan, a financial analyst who's based in Dhaka. And obviously, Manirul, I think the major focus on the Bangladesh situation has been the collapse of the garment factory at Rana Plaza that resulted in the deaths of over 1,100 people, has focused international attention on building and safety standards there. So could we ask you what's been happening in terms of the government improving standards? And also, I understand that some American companies such as Walmart and The Gap want to formulate their own standards. Could you give us an update on where we stand at this time?
What happened that about the Gap and Walmart, they are not still agreeing to sign the European initiative of the retailers of setting new standards for the Bangladesh garment factory. But they are drawing their own line of action, currently revisiting the safety status of the local factories in their supply chain. And it seems in short term, it's meant to reduce the number of factories in the list and gradually build up to the more factories in the list based on the safety standards of their own.
Okay. So with Walmart and The Gap, do you think they'll eventually commit to going along with the standards that other companies are going with?
Yeah, because the fact is Bangladesh is the biggest source of all their products, and if the local industry is willing to do business with them, and with the other European retailers, they will need to meet and contribute to new standards. And hopefully, they will do so.
So, just to sort of finish up here, Manirul, has the disaster at Rana Plaza led to any slowdown of foreign investment from worried foreign companies in terms of what might be happening as far as standards, or has foreign direct investment held up?
Foreign investment between the July 2012 up to April 2013 increased by 8% compared to the last year. But investments are low in dollar terms. These are strategic investments into long-term vision and prospects. So the output is very interesting.
So it's still The foreign investment is still continuing, and it's up about 8% compared with the previous year. All right. Well, thanks very much indeed, Manirul. We'd appreciate your update on that. And it seems as though, despite the tragedy in human terms, because of the commitment by government and by the major international investors, that set standards will increase, and that has not deterred foreign investment too much. Thanks very much indeed, Manirul. And I've been talking to investment analyst Manirul Asan on the line from Dhaka, Bangladesh. My apologies for the quality of that. Sometimes the wonders of the internet and things like Skype are remarkable, but occasionally we will get some where the quality is not as great. When we return, we're going to be talking to financial advisor and demographic researcher Peter Merrick about Turkey and what his research there has led him to conclude. Thanks very much. Please stay with us for that.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
This program comes to you from the EFMI Media Company. EFMI Media is one of the most comprehensive sources of information and analysis on emerging and frontier markets. EFMI Media has become a leader in knowledge, expertise, and analysis of emerging and frontier markets, both in opportunities to investigate and pitfalls to avoid. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca or call 416-944-1750. EFMI Media produces this program, researched and wrote Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, which is set for release later this year, and is currently working on a second book, also on Frontier Markets. EFMI also publishes a newsletter called EFMI Information and provides knowledgeable speakers on these and other topics. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca, or call 416-944-1750.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back. This is Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing, and I'm Gavin Graham. We've suggested in previous programs that changing demographics will help drive emerging and frontier market investment returns in future. And a large part of that, obviously, is going to be increased consumption by a growing middle class. I have financial advisor and demographics researcher Peter Marek on the line. Last week with him, we sorted through what Vietnam's demographic dividend looked like. And this week, we're going to be looking at Turkey, where the demographics have a series of both positives and negatives. Welcome back to the program, Peter.
Thank you very much, Gavin.
Can you give us some idea of where Turkey fits into the scheme of things? Is it fair to place it in the usual sort of picture of emerging markets where you generally have a younger population that's been growing fairly rapidly and there isn't as much of a burden in terms of an aging population and high healthcare costs?
Well, one of the things about Turkey is it's a very young population. About 25% of the population is under the age of 14, which is fabulous because compared to their neighbor to the west, Greece, they have a very small young population. Only 14% of the population in Greece is under the age of 14. And over the age of 65, where you start seeing, you know, people spending a lot of money on health care, the population in Turkey is only 6.1% of the entire population of 80 million people, while over in Greece it's over 20%. So you can see there's a huge difference in the population. 68% of the population in Turkey are working age, and it has a 95% literacy rate, which is something which is very powerful, especially the fact that Europe is seeing itself getting old and they need access to labor and to an educated workforce, and Turkey is able to provide that.
Absolutely. So, as you say, you have a very large working age and a well-educated working age population compared to the more elderly population, poor proportion of the population, compared both to Greece and to the rest of Europe. You stated that actually Turkey has a reverse migration situation with Germany. What do you mean by that?
Well, back in 1961, a few years after World War II, Germany realized that they had a shortage of workers. So they went over and signed an agreement with Turkey that allowed guest workers to come to Germany. So we've got approximately 3 million Turkish citizens who actually live in Germany, and about 4 million individuals have some type of Turkish background in Germany. It's the largest ethnic group other than German
in Germany. They did a study recently, and they found that one-third of college-educated Germans with Turkish backgrounds plan to go back to Turkey because the economy in Turkey has great opportunity. For example, Gavin, which I find very impressive, when the world or Europe was experiencing a recession with a contraction of their economy, in 2010, Turkey saw its GDP grow by 9.2. In 2011, it grew by 8.5. And in 2012, it grew by 3%. To compare that to their neighbor to the west, which is Greece, Greece saw a contraction of 6% last year.
No, I mean, it's, as you say, Greece is obviously, it's almost like looking on the before and after picture, as it were. However, while that's very attractive, we've yet had some of those well-educated youthful populace on the streets in Istanbul protesting. Is that going to be a major concern if you're looking at Turkey as a possible investment destination, do you feel? Or is that merely sort of some of the inevitable growing pains you get with an emerging economy?
Well, throughout the Muslim world, you've seen a rise of radicalism, and what's happening right now is the population in Germany, which is well educated, which the country's been a Republican parliamentary democracy since the beginning. It's had a few However, what you're seeing right now is the democracy. The young population wants democracy. They want their rights preserved. They do not want the government imposing. And that's really good. That's really good for the world to see that the population is basically demanding that their rights of freedom of expression, for the opportunity to work and have gainful employment, to have the rights of their neighbors to the West have in the European Union. This is really something that we have to look at as growing pains. Because, just to put it in comparison how advanced I personally think that Turkey is, in 2003 it eliminated the death penalty. Here's a Muslim country that basically has embraced Western values. The other thing which makes things a lot cheaper is Turkey is one of the only industrialized nations similar to the United States that does not have a state-supported health care. So it's a lot, it's cheaper, and they're able to get away with that because the population over 65 is only about 6.6% of the entire population. Their families are very supportive of the elderly. So it's a vibrant economy, and the fact that the economy is growing at 3% when much of Europe is actually seeing contraction, and they're just a few miles away from the European Union, you're seeing they're having a much different experience. Even though we're seeing what's happening on the streets, I think that's just a hiccup. It's a younger population as well. The population, Gavin, on average is 29 years old. And what they found in demographics, that people start spending, accumulating, and buying things up until they're 48 when they start getting ready for retirement, start saving. So you're looking at a population that has close to 80%, 85% of the population, which are going to be consumers.
They want everything
that the West has. And they've got and one thing I do want to point out, which I find very impressive, it's a huge economy. And it's very urbanized. It's $1.1 trillion economy. And 70% of the population is urbanized. That's very impressive. Very few countries actually have that.
No, I quite agree, Peter. So to summarize, when we sort of wind up the discussion, you mentioned the demographic dividend last week when we were talking about Vietnam. Applying it to Turkey, how would you summarize it as an attractive investment destination? You've already made some of the points, such as the proximity to the European Union, but just in the next, say, 90 seconds, how would you summarize the case for being there?
Well, the demographic dividend is when you have an educated population which is entering the workforce, and you do not have like an explosion, like the birth rate is actually declining. Turkey's birth rate currently is at replacement, 2.1 children, total fertility rate per woman is replacement. They've got about 67% of the population is in the workforce. They're highly educated. They've got governance. They've got a strong economy, and they have trade. And they also have a healthy population. This is going to mean, as a dividend, a demographic dividend, that Turkey is going to be a country that we're going to want to watch. On top of that, with Europe's aging population, they're going to want the Turkish workforce. And that is going to be a boom for Turkey.
That's an excellent summary, Peter. Thank you very much indeed. And as you say,
thank you very much. It's
one of those situations where the present sort of unrest in Istanbul, or indeed in Sao Paulo, as we were discussing earlier with Bill Hinchberger, is not necessarily the sign of major underlying fundamental problems. It may well be that it's a healthy sign. It's a sign that the political involvement of the population is increasing and that government is being forced to pay attention. So our thanks to financial advisor and demographics researcher Peter Merrick for that look at Turkey, which underpins our argument here on Emerging Frontier Markets Investing, that the rising middle class in emerging and frontier markets, and one of the reasons we suggest these countries are likely to remain attractive as investment destinations, as opposed to the slower growing and older developed markets. When I come back, I'll go to a region which there is a great deal of uncertainty about, the Middle East, because obviously there is areas such as Libya or Syria where you see civil war, but there's also very stable countries within that region, such as most of the Gulf Cooperation Council countries. I'm going to be talking to Montasir Khalifi at Quantum Investment Bank in Dubai about whether the problems in Bahrain, further up the Gulf, threaten the safe haven status of the United Arab Emirates. Please stay with us for our final segment. I'll be right back.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
This program comes to you from the EFMI Media Company. EFMI Media is one of the most comprehensive sources of information and analysis on emerging and frontier markets. EFMI Media has become a leader in knowledge, expertise, and analysis of emerging and frontier markets, both in opportunities to investigate and pitfalls to avoid. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca or call 416-944-1750. EFMI Media produces this program, researched and wrote Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, which is set for release later this year, and is currently working on a second book, also on Frontier Markets. EFMI also publishes a newsletter called EFMI Information and provides knowledgeable speakers on these and other topics. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca, or call 416-944-1750.
Do you like what you hear about investing in emerging and frontier markets on this program? Would you like to learn more to increase your investing effectiveness? EFMI Media also publishes a subscription-based newsletter called EFMI. We'd like to tell you more about it. Drop us an email at info@emergingfrontier.ca. We've designed EFMI as a newsletter to provide expert and up-to-date news and analysis of opportunities in the same markets that we discuss here on Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. EFMI has information and analysis that you won't find anywhere else, and you can start receiving it by emailing info@emergingfrontier.ca. This program is produced by EFMI Media, which has become the leader in information about emerging and frontier markets investing. EFMI recently compiled the book entitled Investing in Frontier Markets, opportunity, risk, and role in an investment portfolio, set for release by John Wiley & Sons later this year, and another book, also on Frontier Markets, which will be on store bookshelves later in the year. We are also launching a newsletter called EFMI. For more information, email info@emergingfrontier.ca. For more news about upcoming program segments, the books we have written, or the EFMI newsletter, please email info@emergingfrontier.ca. You can call 416-944-1750.
Save on your prescriptions with the RX Savings Plus Drug Discount Card, offered by Voice America. It is not insurance, and discounts are only available from participating pharmacies. But 9 out of 10 pharmacies participate nationwide. Start saving today. Print your free card online at voiceamerica.rxsavingsplus.com or text the word TALK RADIO to 96362.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. In our previous segment, we looked at the themes that help drive emerging and frontier markets. That's the rise of the middle class. At the same time, it's also important to be not to tar an entire region with one view, because investment generalizations about the whole of North America or the whole of Europe would be regarded as being fairly wide of the mark, and the same is true about the Middle East. To explain that point, I have Montasser Khalifi of Quantum Investment Bank on the line from Dubai. Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing, Montasser.
Hello, Gavin, and all your listeners. Thanks again for this opportunity to talk about Middle East markets.
Not at all. We talked previously about the United Arab Emirates' status as a safe haven in the Middle East. For those who are not with us during the last interview, can you briefly explain why that's the case, why the UAE is a relatively peaceful and regarded as a safe haven?
Yes, UAE has a very stable political situation, and its small population enjoys strong social assistance from the government. Government like healthcare, education, infrastructure. And the country's wealth is relatively well distributed. So as a consequence, we are seeing UAE doesn't have the social problem that other neighbor countries are suffering from. And the UAE is also the country of the region that has the most succeeded in economical diversification. As example, we can cite Dubai, which has established itself as a regional hub for financial markets, services, tourism, transportation, logistics. And in addition, the country has also attracted many expats from all over the world, and which now are representing a huge proportion of its population.
Well, that's a very succinct description of the reasons why the UAE is regarded as a safe haven. Compared to a country that used to be regarded as in a similar situation, that's Bahrain. Moody's, the rating agency, recently stated its negative rating on Bahrain's banking system remains unchanged since 2009, which is negative because of Bahrain's ongoing social unrest, as Moody's describes it, which it says continues to affect investor confidence. Can we believe the UAE, including Dubai, will retain their safe haven status without the problems that Moody's cites in Bahrain?
Yeah, I think that Bahrain has lost its role really in the region because before Dubai, it used to be in the financial capital and capital markets and have been, which can be explained, but by now the business-friendly environment and strong political stability that we are seeing in Dubai, as we talked before. Just a point to add is that Moody's was not only negative on the banking sector in Bahrain, but it has also more recently put the sovereign rating of all the country under review for a possible downgrade.
So it's not only the banking system, but also the country itself that might be in line for a downgrade. Moody's, I think, also stated that non-oil GDP growth in Bahrain will be one of the lowest in the region. Why is that?
We can say that Bahrain has a special situation compared to the other countries of the GCC or Gulf region. It was the first country to discover oil early in last century, and didn't have huge reserves as its neighbors do. So these reserves are estimated now to last only for 10 to 15 years. So Bahrain was obliged to try and diversify its economy, but was not successful on this. It was confronted to social protests, especially ethnical conflicts between ruling Sunni elite and majority of poor Shia. It has troubled the real estate sector also, and fewer non-oil resources. So these
yes,
are
I'd imagine.
For Bahrain. Yeah.
Right, I'd imagine that tourism to things like the Formula One Grand Prix has definitely suffered as a result of those social unrest and the protest. Moving on from Bahrain, there's a transfer of power underway in Qatar. Could you explain what's going on there and what that means for the country?
In Qatar, the situation is really different. Here we are seeing a new thing really original in the region, which is the ruler of Qatar, which Prince Hamad. Has stepped down yesterday in favor of his 33-year-old son. This is seen really as a peaceful transfer of power and will not have an impact on the country's politics or in its continued exploitation of U.S. gas reserves. And the country should also continue its aggressive investment strategy, especially in Europe and UK.
Yes, it's been quite an aggressive investor, as you mentioned, especially in areas like UK property. So, summing up, while the UAE and Qatar continue to go along fairly smoothly, and of course one of the recent developments in the last couple of weeks has been the fact that Morgan Stanley Capital International is going to move them from frontier market status to emerging market status in May next year, which obviously is a big boost to their credibility as investment destinations. Other countries within the region, like Bahrain, still continue to have their issues, but those are specific to Bahrain and they don't have a knock-on effect for other GCC countries.
I'm agreeing on that. Definitely now we are seeing UAE is really and the most performing country in the region, and Qatar, which as we have seen 2 weeks ago, has been recognized by the MSCI index. Bahrain is really a special situation in the region, suffering from the decline in oil reserves, and also from its political troubles and unrest that occurred with all the other movements of the Arab Spring. So, the situation is quite different, and really, you have if you want to invest in the region, you have really to look deeply for each country's special situation.
Indeed. Well, just to finish up, Montessa, we've heard repeatedly Saudi Arabia plans to allow foreigners to invest directly in its equity markets. Do we have any timeline for those changes?
Yeah. In Saudi Arabia, we have, speaking about maybe an open up for foreign investors, there is the timeline for instance, is not yet served. But last week we have the King's decision about changing the weekend from Thursday, Friday to Friday, Saturday. and this is seen as a move to bring the country in line with other countries in the region and also with other with the international all over the region, and it may be seen as the sign of opening the Saudi market to foreign investors. Maybe this should come quickly, especially after the upgrade of UAE and Qatar.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much indeed, Montasa. We really appreciate you updating us on the what's been happening in the Gulf Cooperation Council countries. Thank you.
Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So thanks to Montasa Khalifi at Quantum Investment Bank in Dubai for clarifying what's been happening and why issues in Bahrain, for example, are specific to that country and should not be a concern for investors in the UAE and Qatar. That wraps up today's program, and I hope you'll join us again next week at the same time, where we'll be looking through recent reports on China, where it seems as though there's a slowdown. We've seen a sharp spike in Chinese borrowing rates. So we're going to find out how much effect that will have in terms of a longer-term slowdown. We'll be talking to Professor Robert Lutz at the Southwestern School of Law about the effect on Mexico's economy of the many trade treaties between Mexico and the US and what this can mean for investments. And we'll have another report from African correspondent Samuel Okocha and other reports on emerging and frontier markets investing. I'm Gavin Graham. Our producer is Al Emmett. We are the co-authors of Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk and Role in an Investment Portfolio, scheduled for release by John Wiley & Sons in late summer of this year, another book on frontier markets set for release before the end of the year. We're also the publishers of the EFMI newsletter. For more information, please write to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Again, that's info@emergingfrontier.ca. Thanks, and please join us again next week.
Thanks for listening today to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with host Gavin Graham. Be sure to join us again next Wednesday at 6 a.m. Pacific Time, 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel for another edition. Have a profitable week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.